Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour editorial review. Sponsored by the Wharton Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and editorial review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on producing good food right after this. You know, the deregulation of gas and electric utilities has to stop, and that's because this so-called new system of free market utilities is supposed to be good for consumers, but it's not turned out to be that way. The result has been price gouging and greater risks to the system's reliability. In order to forego this kind of results, all we had to do was to look at what deregulation has done in South and Central America. It has been a disaster there, and we will experience the same results here. Massachusetts deregulated in the late 1990s, and the market was to set prices. We saw what happened in California. Prior to deregulation, electricity prices were 9 cents per kilowatt hour in Massachusetts. Adjusted for inflation, these prices had actually dropped. But since deregulation, prices have risen now by 50%, and between November of 2004 and November of 2005 alone, consumers had rate increases averaging 28%. In regulated states, the increases were kept in single digits. Delaware consumers face increases of 59 to 117% in their electric utility bills, and in Texas, rates are up 80%. Electricity is a necessity, and its production and distribution has to be regulated. And that's because utilities are monopolies, and if they're not regulated, the poor will not have any electricity. We have to take our utilities back, and if we don't, in time, only the fortunate and the well-heeled will have electricity and natural gas. We're moving up our interest rate increase schedule in March, 1/4%, May, 1/4%, and June, 1/4%, and perhaps another 0.25% in August. And if we're correct in this forecast, that's a full 1% interest rise increase. And that'll put mortgage rates on the 30-year fixed mortgage at 7.25%, and 1-year adjustable rate mortgages at about 6.25%. That will have a slowing effect on the housing market further and the economy, as well as in the second half of the year. And what we have to look at next is the rate of increase in money and credit, not only by the Fed, but by Wall Street and government and the banking industry. The ECB, Bank of Japan, Bank of England, and Danish and Norwegian central banks are all tightening their credit. Now the question arises, are these central banks going to cut back liquidity creation, and will Wall Street and the City of London follow suit? Quite frankly, we don't believe it, but let's wait and see. No matter what interest rates are, the key is the increase in money and credit. Another thing to look at is history. In 1997, when the central banks tightened their credit in unison, we had the Asian, Russian, and the LTCM meltdown. That was in 1998. And when Western banks tightened in 1998, 99, and 2000, we had a stock market collapse. Stay tuned. We'll try to find the answers before the crowd. And as far as interest rates, mortgage rates, and home prices are concerned, Australia and England had larger increases in prices in housing than did the United States. And over the past 21 months, growth has ended and prices are now flat in those countries. The difference is that these two countries did not have nearly the leveraged buyers and loans that we have here in the United States. Thus, we see no soft landing here in the United States housing market. In fact, a hard landing in U.S. housing could commence the downside in Australia and England as well. And it could also take Ireland and Spain down with them. Reality Tracks January numbers for property foreclosures showed 103,000 properties nationwide entered some stage of foreclosure. That's a 27% increase from December, and it's a 45% increase year over year. Now, that is the subpar no down payment adjustable rate loans, which were made at 100 to 120% of value that should never have been made in the first place. And of course, those are the first ones to suffer the domino effect. And it'll take up to 4 years now for all of these failures to clear the books. These loans are what allowed this pyramid in housing to grow in the United States. These buyers came in at the bottom, and their buying in the lower tier allowed owners to sell and to rebuy at higher prices other properties, creating the housing bubble that we see today. those bricks are being pulled out of the base of the pyramid. And when you do that, this economic house of cards, this pyramid, comes tumbling down. Now the existing home sales are falling and inventories of unsold homes have doubled. Speculators are still buried with 1 to 25 homes, and that interest rate clock is ticking. A 0.5% to 1% increase in mortgage rates is going to be devastating for borrowers. And someone forgot to tell these homeowners that renting is actually cheaper than buying. Cash out financing and home equity loans are coming to a screeching halt. And that means $600 less for consumers to spend annually. That'll slow the economy with all of the real estate construction and supply business that will be lost right along with it. Unemployment will naturally increase, and it'll increase dramatically, and the spiral downward will widen. Our economy and the world economy will begin to slow in the second half of 2006, and it'll continue to do so for at least a year. Over and over, for the past 5 years, we've been imploring you to get out of debt, so we hope you've listened. Now, we find it hard to believe that anyone can buy the neocon story and reason for invading Iran, and that is, Iran may at some time in the future have a nuclear device. The hypocrisy of all of this is astounding, and Americans have to see it. India broke all of the rules and became a nuclear power back in the 1990s, and now we are granting India full access to our fast breeder reactors. India could attack Pakistan or anyone else in the region. India can go right ahead and produce enriched uranium for weapons. In return, the United States will also import their mangoes and their H-1B professionals by the thousands. Our president tells us that we have to learn how to compete. What he is in effect saying to us then is that we have to learn to live at a third world level to accommodate a transfer of wealth from the United States to India. And the push for development of more nuclear power and the enrichment addition is to get India to cancel its natural gas pipeline with Iran that is already under construction. Eventually, India will also be used as a buffer in any potential conflict with China. And it could be that weapons technology is being given to India to outflank China. This is a very dangerous game. And the technology is being given to India to outflank China. It's a dangerous game because the neocons are playing, and we think that it'll boomerang back into their faces. We know that Georgia and the neocons are doing in Iraq is wrong. But on the other hand, we should discuss the position that we find ourselves in, and it's not a very good one. And that's why the M3 money supply gauge will be suspended in March. The trade in oil in euros on the Iranian bourse will trigger a number of events and a crisis of confidence in the dollar, which means a lower dollar. And the reason that hasn't been discounted in the market is that many investors believe that the United States will find a way very soon to invade Iran. U.S. fiscal and current account deficits get worse by the minute, and we have already seen a crisis in American leadership that can only worsen. The entire Muslim world is now against us, and that will be with us for many years to come. Trading oil in euros means that the dollar monopoly in oil is over and the marketplace will be flooded with dollars. And that means that the Federal Reserve will have to monetize trillions of dollars, and that's immediately inflationary. In euro terms, the dollar could easily trade back to about $1.30 to 1, perhaps as high as $1.36 to 1 before the end of 2006. Now, if and when that transpires, we could see $1.70 by the end of 2070, and that means a gold price in the thousands of dollars. And if the Federal Reserve thinks that by terminating M3 they're going to be able to hide what they're doing, they're sadly mistaken. We know that the elitists do not want the Republicans decimated in the next election, but we'll be able to get the numbers on what they're doing. Hiding M3 is an attempt as well to hide monetization, which is inevitable, and the resulting hyperinflation that's on the horizon. That's why we implore all of you to have almost all of your assets in gold and silver and out of dollars as soon as possible, because the real crisis is just getting underway. And you can expect under these circumstances that oil will go to $120 a barrel. It'll double in price or higher, depending on whether there's further disruption in the supply as we see now in Nigeria. The good news is that globalization and free trade, if that does occur, will be stone cold dead. After a year or two, there'll be a hyperinflationary blow off and a 1929 style collapse, only worse this time. You have to be only in gold and silver during this hyperinflationary period, and in gold only when the depression sets in. The dollar will no longer be in place of a place of refuge. All this should start to unfold over the next 2 to 3 months. So keep your eyes open. All right, there's a little news from the International Forecaster. It's the March 2006 issue, Volume 2. Now, we've been talking about producing good food. What is good food? I don't really know if most people think very much about food quality. Many people do. About 12% of Americans are into organics or into food quality. 88% of Americans go to the supermarket and they're happy and content with what they receive there. Back in the 1940s, a fellow by the name of Edward H. Faulkner wrote a book called Plowman's Folly. And he pointed out that good food starts with good soil, and that the preparation of soil, beginning with a moldboard plow, which was originally intended to destroy soil fertility, to destroy the upper layer of organic material in the soil so that it would make it accessible to planting crops. The moldboard plow isn't designed to enhance soil fertility, but rather to debase it. Today, the use of plows and plowing is as normal as whipped cream or ice cream on apple pie. He begins his argument by saying briefly, this book sets out to show that the moldboard plow, which is in use on farms throughout the civilized world, is the least satisfactory implement for the preparation of land for the production of crops. This may sound like a paradox, but in view of the fact that for nearly a century there has been a science of agriculture, and that agricultural scientists, almost to a man, have used and approved the use of the moldboard plow. Nevertheless, the statement made above is true and capable of proof, and much of the proof, as a matter of fact, has come in left-handed manner from scientists themselves. The truth is that no one has ever advanced a scientific reason for plowing. Many learned teachers have had embarrassing moments before classes of students demanding to be shown why it would not be better to introduce all organic matter into the surface of the soil than to bury it, as is done by the plow. The entire body of reasoning about the management of our soils has been based upon the axiomatic assumption of the correctness of plowing. But plowing is not correct, it's not natural, and it's not what we see in nature. Hence the main premise being untenable, we may rightly question the validity of every popular accepted theory concerned with the production of any crop when the land has been plowed in preparation for its growth. And that brings virtually all of our soil theories up for critical examination. So in this book, the whole gamut of theory that we have evolved concerning the growing of crops will be brought into focus for examination in the light of the discovery that plowing is wrong. Now, the discussion will be undertaken in language common to the layman, so far as is possible, and throughout the text, footnotes will be introduced to explain whatever may be perhaps out of the range of the thinking of the average reader. The nature of the reasoning upon which this entire study is based makes it unnecessary to resort to any but the simplest of scientific terms. Moreover, there are few ideas which are not common knowledge, strange as that may seem. The vast amount of technical language created by scientific agriculture and agriculturalists as a result of the early and fundamental mistake has produced its own confusion, and indeed the mistake originally made might justly be called the basis for most, if not all, of the technology that is connected with present-day agronomy. An agricultural experiment station has its uses, but these obviously would not have embraced the problem presented in this book if those who work the soil had not got off to a false start in the matter of plowing in the first place. In brief, if a way had been found to mix into the surface of the soil everything that the farmer now plows under, and if the implements used in planting and cultivating the crop had been designed to operate in the trashy surface that would have resulted from mixing rough straw, leaves, stalks, stubble, weeds, and briars into the surface, crop production would have been so automatic, so spontaneous, that there might not have developed what we now know as agricultural science. Actually, we would scarcely have needed an agricultural science. From one point of view, we have been creating our own soil problems merely for the doubtful pleasure of solving those problems. Had we not originally gone contrary to the laws of nature by plowing the land in the first place, we would have avoided the problems as well as the expensive and time-consuming efforts that it now takes to solve these agronomy problems. That we would also have missed all of the erosion, the sour soils, the mounting floods, the lowering water table, the vanishing wildlife, the compact and impervious soil surfaces is scarcely an incidental consideration. We have really had a fling at scientific agriculture. The fling, in fact, appears to be the scientific counterpart of what our grandfathers used to call sowing wild oats. It is time that we sobered up and began to apply to the growing of farm crops the same basic science that we have for so long been using in the factories, mills, and workshops of our reasonably progressive civilization. We have equipped our farmers with a greater tonnage of machinery per man than any other nation on planet Earth. Our agricultural population has proceeded to use that machinery to the end of destroying the soil in less time than any other people has been known to have been done in all of recorded history. And this is hardly a record to be proud of. It gains nothing in attractiveness,
And moreover, when we consider that our Chinese friends and the often despised peasantry of the so-called backward countries of the world can produce more per acre without machinery than the American farmer can with all of his fine equipment. And any reasonably well-traveled person will confirm this statement. One of the persistent puzzles has been the fact that an ignorant, poverty-stricken Egyptian who stirs his land with the ancient crooked stick can produce more food per acre than his British neighbor whose equipment is right up to the minute. Now, the explanation is that the poor farmer cannot afford the equipment that would make it possible for him to continue growing such light yields per acre. The full import of all of this will be explained in due course. America, by the way, is number 32 in the world in farmer production per acre. The people in the world who produce the most production per acre are the Egyptians. They're number one. We in America are number 32. Now, there is double meaning in the statement that all of the trouble in producing crops seems to lie in the farmer's fields. The uncultivated fields and woodlands surrounding his land do not show any signs of trouble. Even the crops growing in the fence rows seem to thrive through droughts as well as in fine weather. Would that observation justly, as in wondering whether the manner in which farmers handle their land might be responsible for the way crops grow under tillage or cultivation? Certainly, we should not overlook the possibility that a clue to the farmer's trouble might be found by a comparative study of cultivated and virgin soils. Our conventional ideas of growing processes are due for drastic revision. Much thought and experimental work have been devoted to studies of plant growth, but there has been comparatively little consideration of the part played in plant and animal growth by the actual transfer, more or less directly, of previously used plant food from a lifeless body to one that is living. That is the trash in the soil, the stubble that is left after harvest. And we often think and speak of growth as if it were a building process, which indeed it is. But we're likely to assume without sufficient thought that the best growth would result from the use of materials not previously used in organic tissues. We think of our farm crops as getting a mineral solution from the land, and we think of that solution as originating from soil minerals directly, or from the fertilizers that the farmer applies. We do not give very much consideration to the biochemistry of the organic matter that is left over from last year's crop. We know that anything covering up in the soil or covered up in the soil is subject to rather prompt decay, if it is at all decayable. But we do not reason from that point to acceptance of the decay products as choice building material for crops growing in that soil in the upcoming year. In our material civilization, we have rightly learned to be suspicious of anything constructed of cast-off materials. Very few people would buy an automobile that was assembled from used parts. And a suit of clothes made of shoddy material, used and patched together, would not bring a very good price. Our basic distrust carries over into our thinking about the materials essential to the development of a plant. This would not be true if we did some critical thinking on the subject, but we have not done so, and we're not being taught to do so in our agricultural schools either. And we have left the whole subject to our scientific men, the men who now work in corporate agribusiness. They have learned the facts, and in many instances they have published their findings in books or pamphlets, which anyone who cares to do so may read. But very few have cared to wade through the technical language in which such studies usually have been expressed. And such writings seldom make the headlines or the front pages of our newspapers, so we don't bother to read them. And this may be distinctly bad for us. Now, much of our knowledge of nutritive relationships in food and food products is what might be called academic, pigeonholed after discovery, and then never developed into practical or useful use. Particularly is this true of our knowledge concerning plant nutrition. Now, we know, of course, that no animal can subsist solely on mineral solutions in simple inorganic form. We do not take our lime as lime water or our iron as tincture, at least not to any great extent as a matter of nutrition. Our present knowledge indicates that the human race and the whole of the animal kingdom would disappear completely from planet Earth if we were deprived of that organic storehouse known as the plant kingdom. That being true, it is highly important that we have a thoroughly practical understanding of the nutritive relationships between plants and the Earth, because those relationships are necessarily fundamental to animal well-being, including, of course, human beings. For purposes of this discussion, it will simplify our reasoning process if we think of inorganic solutions, such as those that occur in the soil, where water is in contact with mineral crystals as new or primary plant foods. And the inorganic solutions that originate in the decay of plant or animal tissues as used or second-hand plant foods. These are distinctly not the technician's terms for such concepts, but it will be shown herein that they are useful for the layman in understanding how plants may be made to grow best. And it should be said also that in practice, we would almost never find in the soil any organic solution entirely devoid of inorganic compounds. This is because the water which assists in the decay of organic tissues already carries a load of inorganic compounds when it is absorbed into the organic material. The chief trouble with our farming is that we have concerned ourselves increasingly with the difficult techniques of supplying our farm crops with new materials for growth, when we could easily take full advantage of the almost automatic provisions of nature for supplying plants with complete rations in second-hand form. We've made a difficult job of what should be an easy job. Several circumstances have conspired to distort our point of view on the nutrition of plants. Now, 30 years ago, farmers had not become so familiar as they are today with the possibilities offered by inorganic minerals, such as chemical fertilizers. But as they have learned about these chemical fertilizers, and as the cost of such fertilizers have been reduced from time to time, it has now been progressively easier to use these mineral fertilizers. Meanwhile, the means of restoring organic matter to the soil has seemed at the same time to become progressively more difficult. The net result is that technical attention to the inorganic mineral supply has been more and more necessary, and the organic possibilities have simply vanished from our consideration. Now, the last few paragraphs outline the basic nutritive concepts involved in this book. No new technical discoveries are to be aired here. The discussion is concerned wholly with reducing to practical terms, employable in anybody's backyard or on any farm in the world, the scientific information possessed for decades up to this time, but hitherto not put into any extensive use. Green manures have been known and recommended for decades. For those to whom the idea is new, green manures are simply crops of any kind grown for use as decayable material in the soil where they've been grown. Farmers have been advised for years to make frequent and regular use of green manures to supplement the always inadequate supply of animal manure. In keeping with this idea, county agents as early as 30 years ago urged farmers to make the plowing down of green manures the basis of their soil improvement program for a very thin land. Then, when the results of those early attempts were reported, trouble loomed. Plowing down great masses of green manure proved such a colossal boomerang and failure that subsequent attempts to improve growing conditions for plants have been cautious experiments rather than bold attempts to imitate the perfect example that we see set by the natural landscape out in the forest or out on the prairie. It seems never to have occurred to anybody to question the effects of the universally accepted and approved moldboard plow. The prevalent and generally accepted doctrine concerning green manures has accordingly been modified to two comparatively ineffective recommendations. First, plow down the green manure crop early before it has become woody and difficult to rot. And two, if the crop gets out of hand and becomes woody before it can be plowed in, apply nitrogen fertilizers to the crop itself before plowing the crop down. And even these recommendations have always been recognized as makeshift procedures. It's only too obvious that tender rye or other green crops must contain less minerals than the same plants would contain if these plants had been allowed to reach their full growth. And while the second recommendation is of more recent origin and is supposed to be more advantageous, it has a fundamental weakness for which there is no completely effective remedy in nature. The purpose of adding the nitrogen fertilizer is to hasten the decomposition of the mass, the biomass, thus removing the organic matter as a bar to further rise in the soil of water from deep in the earth. It should be mentioned here that the plowing in of great quantities of absorbent material results in exhausting the water supply from the overlying soil layers for the current crop. The decay is hastened by this trick, but the decay products released are necessarily subject to being leached out of the soil by the first rains that fall after their release. So a relatively small percentage of such nutrients can be retained by the celluloids in soils which have enough celluloids that are not already holding all of the plant nutrients possible. The rest must inevitably be lost, unless by lucky chance insufficient rain falls to carry them away before roots arrive to salvage them. It should be remembered also that in most soils, very few roots ever reach the plow soil or the plow sole to do salvage work. The net effect then of this treatment is likely to be almost nil. Well, hang on here, boys and girls. I got to give you a reminder here at the midway point, and that is that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. And The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours. Just call The Law School, 417-273-4967. Again, to order your free general law CD pack, just call 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite on The Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily 100% endorsed by The Law Hour and editorial review. And the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. Now, for more information about The Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website at georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Edward Faulkner was the son of a farmer. Back in 1880, his dad, when Faulkner was a young man, remember, he wrote this book in 1943. He was an old man and full of years in the 1940s during World War II when he wrote this book, a revolutionary concept, because when I was in ag school, the common accepted formula for farming was that you plow the land first and you come in with a disc second, then you come in with harrows and rollers and a drag third, fourth, and fifth, and then you come in with a seeding operation, either broadcast and then disced in, or you might drill it in if you had a drill. The concepts that we see exposed here in Plowman's Folly are exactly what we see in the forest. You never saw God plowing in the forest to plant new trees. And there's no drought in the forest, but there's a drought out in the field. There's no drought in the fence rows, but there's a drought out in the field. And there's a cause and effect relationship there. Originally, when the early settlers came into Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, the sod was up to a foot thick in places. It was common to be 2 to 3 inches thick. And the settlers had to have a way to break through that sod to plant their crops. So in 1827, John Deere invented the moldboard plow. It was a device that would cut through the sod and turn it upside down so that the roots would be exposed to the sun and that it would kill, it would destroy the organic material that was making that sod so that the settler could get down to the mineral earth below it so that he could plant his crops. That makes all the sense in the world. But it only takes 2 or 3 years to destroy that sod. So why continue with the plowing if the objective was to get through the sod? Well, what happens when a successful methodology is employed, which the moldboard plow was very successful in destroying that upper organic material in the soil? Why not keep doing it? So after the sod had been destroyed, people continued to use the plow. So when we had organic material on top of the soil, that is, from the corn stubble and from the crop stubble, we would take the plow, turn it upside down, and destroy it. And that's what we've been doing since 1827 here in the United States. We came into a region of virgin soils, and we went to work with the express intention of destroying that soil, the organic material in it, and we have succeeded. By 1880, Edward Faulkner's father, John, could see that soil fertility was decreasing exponentially, and Faulkner's father set about to see what was causing this decrease in the soil fertility. He did that, and by the time Faulkner wrote his book in 1943, It had been well established in at least his mind as to what the cause and effect relationship was, which produced the book called Plowman's Folly, which, by the way, is out of print. But there are a lot of these books out there. I've picked up three over the years just accidentally of walking around in used bookstores. But if you ask for the book Plowman's Folly by Edward H. Faulkner, I'm sure that you can find a copy somewhere in America. Now, the reason I bring this to your attention is because it's important to nutrition. What produces good food? Good food is produced in good soil. Plants that do not have available to them iron, boron, or copper cannot produce iron, boron, or copper trace minerals in the plant. I mean, come on, boys and girls, let's be intelligent people. If you plant corn in a soil that has absolutely no iodine, you can rest assured that when that crop matures, when that corn is harvested, there will be no iodine in that corn. So any iodine that your body needs as a building block to building cells is not coming from that corn. Now, we have a problem, in America at least, in getting plants to absorb nutrients, and that's because we plant our plants in chemical fertilizers, and the plants grow prodigiously. I mean, they're beautiful plants, but they're plants that are deficient. They're deficient in nutrients. I mentioned that to you last time when I said that Adolf Steinbrun of Fairbanks, Iowa, put the matter in perspective by having samples of his corn tested for nutrients. And in testing corn samples, they tested 4,000 samples of hybrid corn tested in 10 Midwest states. And Steinbrun's open-pollinated corn contained 75% more crude protein, 875% more copper, 345% more iron, and 205% more manganese. And the same result was also seen in the content of calcium, sodium, magnesium, and zinc. And as a matter of fact, in all of the nutrients. Now, if the nutrients aren't available in the soil, then the plant can't pick it up in the soil. Now, you're going to eat that plant. And if the plant doesn't have the nutrient in it, you're not going to get it. And if you don't get nutrients in your plants, in your food, then your body gets weaker and weaker and becomes susceptible to what we call disease. That's where disease comes from. Starvation. It comes from nutritional deficiency. Now, there's a second way to give you a diseased state of body. We can poison you. That's right. We can put DDT on the plants to kill the insects. Then you can ingest that DDT, which will build up in your body. And over time, you will develop some symptoms. And some people develop symptoms such as allergies. And they sneeze and their eyes water and they're miserable. And they take Dristan and antihistamines. And they go to doctors and buy health insurance and just live kind of a miserable life with their allergies. Other people develop cancer. They go to oncologists and they get cut, burned, and poisoned. And 66% of the time they die and about 37% of the time they live. And it's kind of nasty and miserable. And they don't know what's causing their cancer or their disease, their malaise. The thing that is causing their disease, the thing that is causing their problems is poison or a nutritional deficiency in the plants that they're eating. It's just that simple. That's where disease comes from. So if you're a medical doctor and you're asked the question, what causes cancer? Now you can tell your patient, cancer is caused by nutritional deficiencies and or poisons. As a matter of fact, no matter what disease you have, no matter what symptom you have, no matter how bad you feel, it's caused by starvation, nutrient deficiency, or poison, or a combination of the two. All right, so now we've answered that question. Now, we've actually known this for many years, and we know this in animal husbandry because, you see, we can't afford to give diabetic cows insulin shots every day. I mean, it's not economical. So when a cow gets sick, we have to come up with a solution. And the solution in livestock is that we give them a better, more nutritious balance. Now, I don't use veterinarian services here. I don't need to. And that's because the land itself produces all of the nutrients in the plants that the animals eat if, in fact, the animal has access to the plant. So in dairies, for instance, the reason that you have so much disease in dairy cows is because they're nutritionally deficient. Dairy cows only last 3 to 5 lactations, about 3 to 5 calves, and they're gone. By the time a dairy cow gets to be 10 years old, I mean, that's an old-timer. I've got dairy cows here that are 15 years old. I've had them as old as 23. I've had cows that have had 21 successive pregnancies over a period of 23 years. Now, cows don't live much over 23 years. They usually lay down in the field and die. They get old, and they die of old age. Now, how does one guy have cows that last for 20 years and another dairy farmer? Oftentimes, they only last 1 or 2 lactations. And it's because they put them out into fields that are nutritionally deficient, number one. And number two, they keep those cattle on alfalfa, clover, and grass so that it doesn't taint the milk. For instance, I've mentioned this before. Let me tell you a little story. My cows in the spring of the year will eat other plants. They will eat wild onions and garlic, and they'll eat leaves off of oak trees, and they will eat dog fennel, etc. And it comes through the milk, and it makes the milk taste like those plants. I mean, I can taste the milk and tell you the cow's been in onions, the cow's been in this or that. Well, people in the cities, they don't understand that. You know, bees produce different flavors of honey. Did you know that? When you want alfalfa-flavored honey, you put your beehives next to alfalfa fields. And if those fields are next to eucalyptus trees, those honeybees will go out and they'll mix the eucalyptus with the alfalfa, and then you get a different flavored honey. You know, orange-flavored honey, alfalfa-flavored honey, clover honey, eucalyptus honey. I mean, you can have any flavor of honey that you want. You can have about any flavor of milk that you want. But to maintain uniformity, all of the dairymen in the nation are required to keep their cows off of any pasture, or keep any weeds in those pastures, such as, but not limited to, you know, dog fennel and wild onion, out of those fields. And if they don't, they won't take their milk. All right, so that's simple enough. Now, meanwhile, back on the farm, here, my cows wander all over. Now, when a cow is nutritionally deficient in something, let's say that's boron or copper or iodine, that cow knows what to eat. And if it's available, she'll go eat it. So I keep the woods open. So my cows have pasture, they have grass, they have clover, they have alfalfa, they have mineral blocks, but they also have the forest, the woods, we call them here. And my cows go into the forest, into the woods, and they eat whatever it is they want. They can eat acorns, they can eat the cedar boughs, they can eat needles, they can lick on the ground. I saw a bull the other day, he's licking the ground. Well, there was salt in the ground. That's where I had a salt lick. So he's there licking up the dirt. His body told him that he needed something, so he's over there licking it up. Those animals will just naturally eat whatever it is they need. As a result, their bodies are balanced, they're healthy animals, and they don't need veterinarians. They don't get sick. Human beings do the same thing. If your cow can balance her diet, so can you. Let me give you an illustration. Have you ever sat down and ate strawberries? Try it. Strawberry season's coming up. Just sit down. Boy, they're going to really taste good. Don't limit it. Strawberries are filled with vitamin C. We use vitamin C in our diets every day, and strawberries are a good source of vitamin C. You're going to love those strawberries. So you sit down, and you eat strawberries. All right. Want some more? Eat some more. Eat strawberries until you just get sick of them. And what your body is telling you is, I've got all the vitamin C, I've got all the vitamins and minerals that are in those strawberries, and I don't want to see another strawberry. Test it. Buy a bunch of bananas and bring them home. Sit down and eat one banana. You're probably now satisfied because the potassium content of that banana is extremely high. Different foods have different concentrations of these minerals and vitamins. And bananas happen to have a very high concentration of potassium. When you're hungry for a banana, your body is telling you that it's hungry for potassium. That's what your body is signaling. So when you eat that banana, God, it really just tastes great. All right, now sit down and eat a second one. By the time you get through eating the second banana, your stomach down there is saying, I've got all the potassium that I need. I really don't want any more. Now, peel a third banana and sit there and force yourself to eat that third banana. Let me assure you that before you can get that third banana down, you're going to puke. And that's because your body is designed, when it overdoses on something that's natural, I mean, you can do this with anything. Just sit there and start eating honey. You can just sit there and eat honey until you puke. That won't happen with strawberry ice cream. You can sit there and drink Pepsi-Cola and eat strawberry ice cream until hell freezes over, because there's little or no nutritional value in it. And it tastes real good. And if taste is the indice that causes you to eat, you can just sit there and eat and eat and eat. That's why we're so fat. We Americans eat nutritionless food. We eat food that does not have nutrients in it. And then we wonder why it is. Why it is that we get disease. Why it is that we get fat. We eat calories and we put on pounds and pounds. But our stomachs keep telling us, I'm not getting enough potassium. So you eat more strawberry ice cream, which really tastes good. And you put on more pounds, but you're not getting any potassium. That's because the potassium is in bananas. The vitamin C is in strawberries. Now, what we're finding out is that the strawberries have less and less vitamin C, less and less of the vital nutrients, the minerals in them. And so we're eating more and more, trying to get those nutrients, just like the cow. But the cow goes down, she takes a couple of bites of oak leaves, and that's enough. She goes on to something else. Let me give you a quick reminder. You know, Leviticus 19:19 tells us, you shall not sow your field with mingled seed. Well, hybrid seed and genetically modified organisms are a crime. They violate the law of God. And a study from Cornell University says that an increasingly popular commercial corn, genetically engineered to produce a bacterial toxin to protect that corn against pests, has an unwanted side effect. Its pollen kills monarch butterflies, butterfly larvae, and laboratory tests. And the questions that Cornell left unanswered are even more telling. What else does it kill? Surely butterflies aren't the only unintended victims here. You know, poisons, after all, aren't very picky. Does it cause mutations? And if so, what plants, animals, or insects are affected? When do you know if you're eating it? Is it in your grits? Is it in your cornbread? We know that it turned up in Taco Bell tortillas. And if it's in a food product, will it be labeled as containing genetically modified organisms, also known as GMOs? Will stores pull those products from the shelves like they did with tortillas after they got caught? Or will they just ignore the problem and look the other way and sell it to you anyway? Well, so far, governments, the Department of Agriculture, the Food and Drug Administration, and the multinational seed, petrochemical, and food processing corporations have ignored critics of agricultural biotech who want the government to require labeling food that contains GMOs. And in this battle between your health and safety and the financial interests of these multinational seed and food processing companies, you lose unless you have your own non-hybrid open-pollinated seed that are not genetically modified. Now, if you'd like to know more about this multinational corporate monopoly of our seed and food supplies, and how you can become independent from them, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package? Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. And it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge. You can call and order yours right now. Remember the number to call, 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to the website, it's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for that free General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or you can call direct, 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, next time we'll take a further look here at moldboard plows and Edward Faulkner's book on Plowman's Folly and put together for you this concept of good food comes from good soil. If you have good soil, the plants that you plant may not necessarily take up those nutrients in the soil because of hybridization, the violation of Leviticus 19:19. So we'll take a look at this biblical connection. Good soil, good seed, good plants equal good health. All right, you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on our website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.